extraordinary joy and privilege it is to stand in this pulpit and this reading lectern in this particular church and open a little, at least, those two windows into the heart and love of Jesus Christ, which he fashioned when he made Nicholas Ferrer and George Herbert. So we had a wonderful gospel reading. Jesus said to Matthew, "Come and follow me." And we are about to follow in the footsteps of two men who, in their very different ways, were like Matthew, sitting in the tax booth. That was a nice one. Sitting at the receipt of custom, I think, is the phrase in the Authorized Version. They were certainly involved in the midst of the busyness of this world, both men. But who, like Matthew, whilst sitting at the receipt of custom, heard a call to follow. A call that radically changed the direction of their lives. For both of them, arising and following Jesus led them out of the throng and press, the apparent centrality of court and city and university, to the love and care of the small, the particular, the marginal, the neglected, finding afresh there the true centre in the Word who was made flesh. And that call to love and care in the least expected but most particular of local habitations actually led them to care particularly and materially for the two churches between which we will be walking in their spiritual company, this church here in Leighton Bromswold and the church at Little Gidding. Now, Nicholas Ferrer, having graduated from Clare, like so many Cambridge graduates of that day and this, went on to become what is euphemistically called something in the city. There were bubbles in those days too. There were wonderful investments that then turned out to be sharp practices with slightly dubious means of gathering in rents and incomes. And it was perfectly possible then as now for clever young men to come in with a certain amount of financial wizardry and interest, but then find themselves drawn into, tangled up with all kinds of practices which on mature reflection they might not want to be part of. That certainly seems to have been part, at least, of the story of Nicholas Ferrer. Very strongly involved in the Virginia Company, which was obviously involved in the whole foundation of the colony of Virginia. I think he may have been, I think it was one of the Ferrers who was the first English girl to be called Virginia after this great enterprise. And of course, for us, the entire story is darkened and shadowed by the question of slavery, but it was further, not to mention tobacco. Yes, if the church commissioners were looking for a series of things from which it might be prudent to disinvest, wouldn't be a bad place to start. And yet, there was hope, there was idealism, there was a tremendous sense of how you might make a new society. There was a great deal of good as well. But what Ferrer, of course, discovered was that there was also sharp accountancy, and there seems to have been, as it were, a company within the company that was kind of creaming off the profits. And he attempted to reform that. He actually did attempt to lead a reform group within the Virginia Company and found all the things that any person of ideals and virtue seeking to reform a large self-interested organisation come up against. But he did, I think, make a difference. But also, somehow in the course of that struggle, there was an awakening of conscience, there was an opening up of the inner ear, there was a hearing of this calling, and there was a realization to do something completely counterintuitive. Instead of establishing a big, grand, high-profile, commercially successful new colonial venture abroad, he came back, as it were, into the heart of England and rediscovered and refounded and began again an effort at profound Christian community living, which had previously been lost. So that was, as it were, sitting at the receipt of custom there in the new money in the city. Suddenly, you might think the most unlikely candidate for a profound reintegration of the deepest and oldest Christian traditional values. It happened there to Nicholas Ferrer. And of course, George Herbert, his great friend from Cambridge, equally ambitious, equally brilliant Cambridge man, looking for a combined glittering career in both the university and the nation through a combination of getting high post in the university and becoming a member of parliament and getting the attention of the king, working to get the much sought after place of university orator, something which not only allowed him to display his extraordinary learning and rhetorical skills, but quite frankly gave him a series of one-to-one conversations with the most influential people of the nation, starting with the king on downwards, who had the powers of patronage. That was part of the gig. And of course, to be the university orator was to have attained to perhaps the most sophisticated, bombastic, grown-up role you could get in a university which rather liked to be sophisticated, bombastic, and grown up. And no sooner had he attained this this wonderful possibility of being something Cambridge people have occasionally been known to be, of being apparently infinitely superior but swathed in wreaths of adult irony which are impenetrable to anybody else, the usual Cambridge mould. He's just attained that when, as he himself so beautifully put it, "Methought I heard one calling, child. And I replied, my Lord." The power of Jesus Christ to cut through the swathes of Cambridge students and don pseudo-sophistication and actually reach into that inner child and bring him alive again. And Herbert's fidelity in hearing that call and the clarity and freedom with which he shakes off the trammels of Cambridge is just a lesson to be learnt for all. A wonderful, wonderful example. So, both men were called, as Matthew was, to a work of restoration and reparation. Both men were called literally and metaphorically, as indeed earlier St. Francis was, to rebuild my church. And that is why we start here. "Yea, the sparrow hath found her a house, and the swallow a nest where she may lay her young." It might have been slightly easier when George Herbert first came to be prebend of Leighton Bromswell for the swallow to find her a nest and a sparrow a house for her young, since conveniently there wasn't a roof to keep them out. The place was fairly ruinous and patched up haphazardly, and it was extremely difficult to keep and hold divine office here. Now comes another of those wonderful, creative, counterintuitive reversals. What happened in most cases, the way the church and state relations and the business of tithing and so on worked in those days, was that if you were made the prebend of somewhere, you certainly didn't have to be there, but the main idea was that you had been given a flock which you could fleece. You put a curate at very small pay in to do the minimum amount of just grinding out the services, then you took everything in the tithe barn and used it to feed your household and furnish your new place in London. That was what people were doing all over the country. That was why they asked to be prebends of places. On the contrary, George Herbert starts annoying all his wealthy relatives and asking his mother to write to her best connections in the aristocracy and raises funds to put the roof back on this church, raises funds to restore the windows, to lay the church floor, to completely reorganize the fabric of the church, physically, to rebuild it. Far from fleecing his flock, he actually set up a trust fund in order to reclothe it and protect it against the elements. And Pharaoh, in the meantime, having found Little Gidding and found the church there also in ruins, was beginning to do the same thing. And at the purely physical organisational level, it seems the two men clubbed together and realised that they were both in the business of restoring churches not far from one another, that they would need to deal with the same timber merchants, the same craftsmen, the same stonemasons, the same glaziers, that they might as well get together and organise the refurbishments together, and that's what they did. And really, Ferrer and Herbert ought to be made together as a pair the patron saints of every church fabric committee. They are the people who from heaven look down with rejoicing and pour special blessings on those who stay up when they could be down the pub on a Saturday night working out the details of how to keep the fabric of a church going. But as patron saints of fabric committees, they would also have a special spiritual charge, because whilst they were both outwardly concerned and properly and in detail concerned with the outward and visible fabric of both the churches that we worship in today, they were, to borrow the other half of that phrase from the 39 Articles of Religion, they were equally concerned with the inward and the spiritual. And they saw those things as utterly tied together. So, whilst they were working on the outward fabric, they were both doing extraordinary things to restore the inner and spiritual. Just as they were working on the physical fabric of the church at Little Gidding, so the Ferrer household were beginning to restore through prayer what was lost in the life of the Church of England. Prayer, community, that vision of how to live together we glimpsed in Acts, the things that had been lost and missing after the spoliation of the monastery, offering education to those around them, growing the herbs, making a place of hospitality, and centering it all so beautifully, particularly in the round of the Psalms, and making sure that the Psalms were continually said. And the place was soaked in prayer just as much as it was full of the activity of physical rebuilding. And in just the same way, through his particular gift for poetry, Herbert was doing something extraordinary. He had, as it were, firmly on his agenda things like windows, church lock and key, church porch, church floor. Every one of those is not only an item on the agenda for the Leighton Bromswell St. Mary the Virgin Fabric Committee, but is also the title of a poem by George Herbert, in which these outward and visible things are given again the breath of life and their inward and spiritual meaning. He wants to restore this that is visible in order that it should become for everyone who steps through this door radiant with the glory of the invisible. The word made flesh, the word made stone and glass and light. And it's with one of those poems that I particularly wish to conclude, the one we heard read today, The Windows. And if I were to introduce that poem, I might introduce that poem, The Windows, to conclude these words, with a question from another poem, a poem that must surely be, I don't want to use the phrase subtext, but as it were, the undercurrent, the cantus firmus, the ground song for almost all of us here, and that, of course, is T.S. Eliot's poem, Little Gidding. Eliot asks the question in that poem, why should we follow these dead men more than the dying? Well, perhaps one of the reasons why we might really want to follow and consider the lives of these dead men now living gloriously in Christ, Nicholas Ferrer and George Herbert, is actually to be found, the answer to that question, in Herbert's poem, The Windows. Herbert starts with the apparent complete dilemma between the utterly true and beautiful and spiritual and the contingently broken, dusty, earthy, incomplete particularity of us. Lord, how can man preach thy eternal word? He is a brittle, crazy glass. I love that particular phrase, brittle, crazy glass. You may know that in early glass making, there was a bit of a trade-off between whether you could make the glass strong enough not to be brittle, not to break. But to do that, you had to make it quite thick, and then it becomes crazed. You've probably all seen the old glass in old windows, which it's a bit thickened in some places and not in others, and it produces. So you could make it not brittle, but it would be crazed, or you could try and make it really thin and not crazed, but then it would be brittle. And George Herbert candidly says to God, well, if I was a piece of glass, I'm afraid I managed to be both brittle and crazy at the same time. But there we go. How can you use me? He is a brittle, crazy glass. Yet in thy temple thou dost him afford this glorious and transcendent place to be a window through thy grace, that where something about us that can be opened to and passed through the light. And then in this poem, Herbert goes on to use that very beautiful word, anneal. When thou dost anneal in glass thy story, making thy life to shine within the holy preachers. Now, as I'm sure many of you know, this is a word about how you get the colour into glass, into a piece of stained glass. And obviously you can't just take the glass as it is and paint it on the surface. It would be painted glass then and not stained glass. And of course it would eventually rub off and scrape off and scratch off. So you have to get the colour right into the glass. And in order to do that, basically you have to heat the glass up. You have to almost return it to its molten and original state before it was first formed, however brittle or crazed that may be. That you've got to take it right back to its beginnings and then get the glass, get the colour into it. Then let it form so that the colour is right within. Now, isn't that an extraordinary metaphor for what Jesus Christ does with us when we offer him, brittle and crazed as it may be, the glass of our lives? When he, as it were, puts the pressure and the heat on and we open up to him and to his passion and his hurts, just those moments when we are most experiencing our passion and our hurts. And what can happen then, if we're open to him, is that the very colour of the passion of Jesus Christ, the very colours of his unconditional love, somehow flow into and fuse with the colours of our own passion. And his story becomes intrinsically and from the inside part of our story, just as he chooses to make our story part of his in taking on our flesh, bringing it through the cross and grave and to the resurrection. And it's an astonishing poem, this, because, of course, it doesn't ever use the word stain or stained glass. And interestingly, the word stain, in terms of its connotations, is a dark word. There's hardly any context in which the word stain doesn't carry some sense of the spoiled, the imperfect, the sinful, except stained glass. In stained glass, stain is utterly redeemed. It is utterly renewed. It becomes translucently beautiful and has a right place in God's holy house. And of course, that is exactly what every redeemed sinner is. Somebody whose stains are utterly, they're not taken away. Those you know, darkened or powerful or highly coloured passages of our lives are not, as it were, overwritten and reduced to some kind of bland niceness again. But the passion and story of Jesus Christ is annealed into them. And it's that fusion of the two things, actually the integrity of their living and their life of prayer that both men offer us. For both of them, there is that. And Herbert, once again, echoing his beloved Book of Common Prayer, makes that clear in this poem where he says, doctrine and life, colours and light in one, when they combine and mingle, bring a strong regard and love. You see, he's echoing that prayer for the clergy, that the pray for all bishops and curates, that they may both by their life and doctrine set forth thy true and lively word and rightly and duly administer thy holy sacraments. So Herbert at least offers the possibility that some Christian lives might become windows, and that they won't be waterish, bleak, thin windows. They'll be passionate, colourful, maybe occasionally crazy and brittle, but vivid, true and lively windows. And that, it seems to me, is just the case when we look up and glimpse into the lives of these two men. Their lives became windows. And the story of Jesus Christ, who himself came from a rich centre, the glory of heaven, and buried himself like they did in the strange countryside of a small poor margin, a stable at Bethlehem, on a planet that fringed some outer galaxy. And from that particular marginal place, in a life of self-sacrificial loving, re-established a new centre from which the love and the grace of God Almighty could flow afresh into earth. It is his story which is annealed into the glass of the lives of Herbert and of Ferrer. And remembering them, walking with them on this pilgrim, remembering in their company, as we will do later on this pilgrimage, some of the other saints of these islands, we may glimpse afresh that light of his passion. But if I can end by borrowing another phrase from Eliot, it won't be a case of following an antique drum. It won't be a case of wishing we were back there and then. I hope it'll be a case of discovering that the same truths, the same love, the same glory can be revealed also now in one another. Renewed, says Eliot, transfigured into another pattern. Amen.